Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
I'm Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Today is August 11th, 2011, double 11s, and I want to thank our listeners for sticking with us throughout these many months and learning about your rights in the United States, which I think could probably translate over into other countries as we discuss global events also. On the first Thursday of each month, we have Greg Glaser, a specialist in constitutional law, and I'm looking forward again to having him in September because we've got a lot of issues to discuss that deal with our rights and how they are reflected in the Constitution of the United States. Alan is a leading vaccine rights attorney who advises individuals, families, other attorneys, groups, and organizations throughout the United States. He tells me he's been very busy lately dealing with vaccine exemptions and waiver rights. He supports many legislative initiatives, and we're going to be discussing that today, especially what's going on in Colorado, in the state of Colorado. And he also has been published internationally on vaccine health and legal matters. And you can read his writings on a major website called Natural News with Mike Adams. And there's an important article up there, right? I think you put it up. Alan, did you put it up this week? Let's see, February 22nd. Is that the one? Proposed limits on vaccine exemptions, are they constitutional? That was put up on February 22nd, but you have another one, perhaps.
Right, one that was posted on August 3rd concerning proposed vaccine exemption forms by the Colorado Board of Health.
Okay, and that is perhaps where we're going to start, unless you wanted to start off with the news about Bill Gates.
I'm not up on that one. Why don't you go ahead and brief us on it, Debbie, and then we'll slide on over into the Colorado issue.
Okay, it's just a message that I received this morning. You know, Twitter is an amazing place. You learn a lot by being part of the social networking and getting the news first on Twitter, and we can all work together there and get our waves of awareness on the Twitter sphere. So Bill Gates Foundation partnered in Malawi, who vaccinates 131 children at gunpoint, reads this article. I'm reading from a website called The Activist Post. It's a really cool little title. Their slogan is, "Interrupt your regularly scheduled programming." I think that's kind of cute. It says, the Gates Foundation has long been in an aggressive effort to vaccinate the world and often targets poor Africans. The Gates website showcases Melinda Gates applauding Malawi for enforcing vaccine programs with its helpful, quote-unquote, health surveillance assistance, unquote. She calls Malawi one of the few countries on track to reach the UN Millennium Developmental Goal. And who are these assistants meeting the goal? Hypervigilant medics with help from police. Bill Gates calls the vaccine autism link an absolute lie. Well, he hasn't been talking to the other side of the story. And in February, CNN interview said, quote, the people who go and engage in those anti-vaccine efforts, you know, they kill children, unquote. But as we can see from the recent actions from governments who partner with his foundation to forcefully implement vaccine programs, it could very well be the other way around. Malawi Voice recently reported that about 131 children from, and it's spelled N-S-A-N-J-E, Naji, were vaccinated with anti-measles at gunpoint last week. They had fled from previous vaccine mandates into nearby towns, but after officials learned they had returned, medics along with police escorts tracked the children and forced them to vaccinate. Wow, it sounds like hunting down prey. The children belonged to Zion and Atamwe churches, and parents took them into Mozambique to hide from officials with vaccines. It is unclear if those churches prohibit the use of vaccines, but a Malawi man with a Seventh-day apostolic faith found himself sentenced to 2 years imprisonment for refusing to let his three children receive the measles vaccine. He did not believe in going to doctors or receiving vaccinations. Police said that they believed one of his children died from measles and he was charged for endangering life by failing to supply necessities of life to a person under one's care without lawful excuse. According to a penal code, he pleaded for a light sentence because he cares for orphans, but the charges stand. It's almost finished, this article. The Gates have repeatedly emphasized their goal to vaccinate every child on earth, and it is clear that children and parents have no say in the matter. These families may have fled the vaccinations because of information, witnessing its harmful effects in others, religious beliefs or hunches. Maybe they know it's bad medicine, or a modern version of smallpox blankets, a damaging, ineffective, toxic cocktail. Whatever the case, they had no choice. The Gates banner says, human rights, we come generously bearing good gifts of health and peace. Take the gifts or else get shot, says this article. It is also clear that the Gates applaud and support this type of force. Either way, the children get shot. Every month, 11,000 of these health surveillance assistants spend 3 weeks providing health care vaccinations and information and 1 week in the rural health clinics. And they also make sure the vaccinations happen, not just at the village level, but all the way back through the system, Melinda Gates said. And they do. This article ends with guns and needles aimed and loaded. So it's pretty hyped up. And, you know, I am a person who tends to keep a low key and balance on issues, and I want to hear all sides. I want to make sure that the information is valid and factual. And I'm reading this article. I'm assuming that it has actually happened. Someone would have to verify it. But the point of this whole thing is why we have the show, because we do need to have our rights and freedoms to decide for ourselves, for our person, for our families, whether we go for a vaccination, whether it's one vaccination or many vaccinations. That is our personal health care right. And what we're hearing is against the laws of nature. So I'm going to leave it with you, Alan, to move forward with today's discussion.
Yeah, I didn't realize that was a specific issue you were referring to, Debbie. It's been a busy week. That one has been around the news for a few days, and it raises, of course, very serious questions. And one's first response might be, well, of course, that would never happen here. I don't want to be an alarmist, but I also want to be very realistic. We saw with the swine flu pandemic a level of panic that ultimately turned out to be over a non-existent pandemic. And yet there were states declaring emergencies. Virginia declared an emergency without even documenting a single case of swine flu. And That's the kind of reaction that we saw. And people lined up, you know, in lines for hours in some places to get their swine flu shots. People were scared. What would happen if we had a real pandemic in terms of the level of fear? There's no telling what people will do when they're scared. And
well,
over there,
just look at the UK today.
Right. So, but my point is this, you know, there's a tendency when we hear about a lot of different things that happen in third world countries to say, thank God we live here and that sort of thing doesn't happen here. And while we wouldn't see that happen here with the administration of routine immunizations, although we saw something close to that in Maryland a couple of years ago where they were threatening to throw parents in jail if they didn't get their kids immunized for school, and there was a high percentage or number of parents whose kids were not up to date. That's pretty draconian in and of itself, and of course, holding up guns to get people vaccinated is just horrific. In one sense, I mean, this is a massively multifaceted, complex issue, but in one sense, it is very, very simple. And with regard to this vaccinated gunpoint kind of mentality, the reality is that vaccines carry a risk of death or permanent disability. And the question about a government imposing that risk on anybody against their will is, I just don't see how that can ever be justified, ever. The government might say, we recommend this, and if you don't do it, we might quarantine you if there's an outbreak or a serious risk or what have you. That seems very reasonable to me. But to say that your child has to incur a risk of permanent disability or death because of a hypothetical future exposure to disease, especially in a developed nation where that's uncommon, is just absurd. But even in a third world country, you're saying you have to take this risk of death or disability because of, you know, the possible death or disability from the disease. And there's just no way. The FDA and CDC have both said the vast majority of adverse drug events are never reported. So there's no way for anybody to do a cost-benefit analysis. The data for doing such analysis is literally non-existent. But even if it was, even if there was a proven, demonstrated, everybody, nobody questions cost-benefit analysis, to say that any individual has to take that risk for the protection of someone else just doesn't make sense in ethical and moral terms. So it's a real serious problem. Of course, it's much more serious when people like Bill Gates start making blanket statements like anti-vaccine people are killing people. That's a horrific thing to say, not just because it's horribly inaccurate, but because it's using fear to manipulate and control people, and that is just, again, inherently and blatantly immoral and unethical. Both the falsity of the statement and the deliberate and obvious blatant use of it as a manipulative tool rather than a means of communicating information. Lost my train of thought of where I was going with that, but we could go on here at length. Let's reel it back in over to a legal issue where it's a little more of my focus and expertise, unless there's any further comments you want to make on that one, Debbie.
No, I was just bringing forth some current events, some news articles, so that people realize how important it is that they must stand up for themselves, for their family, that unless we say something, a larger, more powerful vehicle will take over for us and do whatever they want.
Well, has already done and is already doing, really, on a practical level. The question is what we can do. But the other thought now that just came back to me that I wanted to say was that despite the, you know, obvious target of criticism that such statements are for those of us who are informed on the issue, there's actually a bright side to these kinds of statements about anti-vaccine people. If we were not posing a risk or threat or concern to these growing, ever-expanding pharmaceutical profits and any other agenda that may be underlying the pro-vaccine movement and agenda, they wouldn't feel the need for such strong and sweeping language. And I think it's an indication that they're scared, frankly. They see that we are actually making ground. I just, you know, one of the articles I just saw today, I think, was talking about increasing exemption rates in Arizona and Washington State. Probably the reason they passed their, what in my opinion is an unconstitutional restriction on access to exemptions law recently, is because they, according to another recent article, Washington State leads the nation in vaccine exemptions.
Lead
the nation in terms of percentage of people claiming exemptions.
So more people claim exemptions in Washington State than in other states?
According to a recent article, and that would explain why the governor might have felt the need to sign into law restrictions on vaccine exemptions that, frankly, are unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they're feeling the need to take more desperate measures because we're gaining ground. And that's the point I wanted to bring here. It potentially you could call this a glass half full, half empty issue here, but it looks to me like we must be gaining some ground. There must be a growing number of people who are waking up, who are coming to their senses or realization about the issues with vaccines and are not buying the hype we get from people like Bill Gates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's using his position of power and influence to manipulate and control us, not to provide, not for entirely benevolent purposes. Now, there may be a mixture. Maybe he's doing some wonderful work in the world in some ways, but clearly some of what he's doing is either severely misinformed or has some other less than benevolent agenda.
Right. I think that, you know, if this is for the human good worldwide, that he's doing all of this and investing billions of dollars into a vaccination program, he actually believes that it will be good. He believes that he will save the world from disease.
I'm not going to pretend to know what he believes or doesn't believe, but I will look at what he's doing and what the possible effects of it are.
Right. And I guess, you know, there's no balance coming from that side in terms of human rights, and that's what we need to continue. Let's focus on that. And in America right now, you're talking about Colorado. Did you want to discuss, or did you have further about Washington State?
Well, actually, Washington State will factor in, and frankly, the rest of the nation into a discussion about Colorado. I'm using Colorado really as an example because there is a specific issue there, but these are issues very similar to the ones that we just dealt with in Washington State, and unsuccessfully from the point of view of those of us who wanted to see constitutional law prevail there and freedom of choice. But these are issues that are not going to be just limited to Colorado or to Washington State. We're going to see this around the country. There are growing exemption rates around the country. This is a real concern to the pro-vaccine agenda. And so they are, I suppose necessarily from their particular point of view, looking for ways to eliminate or restrict or minimize the exercise of exemptions. So, I mean, as a kind of broad starting point with regard to, let's say, religious exemptions, the prevailing view is that our federal constitution does not require states to offer a religious exemption, and despite that, 48 states do. So that right there, I think, is testimony to the value that we as a nation place on religious freedom. And just as a quick note here for listeners, what qualifies for a religious exemption? Because a lot of people hear religious exemption and they say, well, I'm not a Christian Scientist, or I don't go to church or whatever, I couldn't qualify. Well, what qualifies for religious exemption is potentially just about anything or any, in terms of religious beliefs, or anyone that is not an atheist. These are generalizations that can vary with specific contexts, but generally it doesn't matter whether or not you belong to a church, doesn't matter which one you belong to if you do. So again, potentially anyone who's not an atheist could qualify for religious exemption. There are legal pitfalls in situations, in particular any ones where you have to write a statement of your beliefs. you know, what are your religious beliefs that are opposed to immunizations? There are some pitfalls there. So folks who are in that kind of a situation where you have to state your beliefs, it's a good idea to get some more information or perhaps even consulting or whatever to have a really legally sound statement. But it's really broad what qualifies. But anyway, you would think that if a state, or I would think, I'll put it in terms of myself, I would think from a common sense level that if a state didn't have to offer religious exemption, that if they decide to offer it, they could qualify it any way they want to. Again, just on sort of a common sense level. But it turns out that that's not true. The 14th Amendment of our Constitution, the Due Process Clause in particular, requires that some parts of our Constitution, sections of the Bill of Rights, which includes the First Amendment reference to the free exercise of religion, that these so-called fundamental rights apply to state and local governments, because originally the federal constitution only applied to the federal government. So when a state offers a vaccine religious exemption, you automatically have First Amendment rights that attach to that. That's a very good thing, because federal rights, federal First Amendment rights, is a higher legal authority than state law. What that also means, though, is that when states offer a religious exemption, they have to do so within the boundaries of the First Amendment. And this brings us to the first point that of my concern with Colorado. Colorado, I think it was back in March or sometime in the spring, it was May, I believe, they had a meeting with their immunization program, and they have some proposed religious exemption form or exemption forms, medical, religious, and personal or philosophical. They're calling their philosophical one, I believe, a personal exemption. But they created separate exemption forms that are proposed forms. They're going to vote on that, I think, sometime next month. So this is a time for anyone who might be concerned about these forms, in particular in Colorado, or these same issues in other states, either that have already come up, such as Washington, or that I feel no doubt will be coming up in more states. This is an opportunity for us to look at some of these issues.
Right. We need to act now before something gets signed into law. And because they're going to be a model for the rest of the states, what one state can push through, then the other states think that they can. So tell us exactly, so we know, what is the problem with their proposed exemption forms?
Well, I have a long list of concerns, but let me first start by saying in Washington State, we were recently dealing with a state statute or a bill that then became law. It was voted into law, and the governor signed it into law, and is now a new state statute. We were dealing with a statutory level. Here in Colorado, I think we're dealing primarily with the regulatory level, with the Board of Health, and as a state agency. Oftentimes we see states will have a statute that provides a religious exemption right, but then it'll be the state Board of Health or some similarly named health agency in the state that will decide the details about how you exercise the right. They will often create forms. When agencies provide any additional details or procedures to statutory law, they have to do what they do within the boundaries of the statute. That is, if a state law says one thing, the agency can't come along and say something that directly contradicts the statute. As long as what they're doing, though, is within the confines of the statute, they have a lot of freedom for adding detail or creating procedures and so forth. So there were a lot of points here, but I want to say right up front, now I'm picking on Colorado's Board of Health and their proposed forms here. I want to just say up front, though, I'm really intending these concerns, both in this article of Natural News and our discussion today, to address these issues more generally. And if people, those of you in Colorado, or if you know people in Colorado, have them contact the National Vaccine Information Center Advocacy Portal. Get on board with those folks, because they're on the ground there, so to speak, in Colorado and in states around the country. But they have an active Colorado director. And no
that's
smokes.
NVIC.org?
NVIC.org, there's a link on that page, the NVIC homepage, to the advocacy portal, which is actually a separate internet address.
Okay.
You can also just search NVIC advocacy portal, and that'll take you right to the page if you throw that into Google or any other search engine. So I encourage people to get in connect with those folks to align with their particular strategy. They may, they and others who look at this letter in the form of an article here, or an article in the form of a letter on Natural News, and they may feel that they want to use some but not all of these particular arguments as a strategic or other matter. So I encourage people to contact the NVIC and coordinate with them as it pertains to Colorado specifically. But let's talk about some of these. One of the first things they do, now previous, well currently, they have a single form the doctor signs off on the vaccines that a child has received, or there's spaces at the bottom of that same form where they can check off religious or personal exemption. So it's a fairly straightforward process. What the Board of Health is looking to do is to break that up into separate forms. And they want to break it into separate forms, it appears, so they can add a lot more information on the forms. So we'll talk about some of that today. But the starting place, and probably my biggest concern, is the religious exemption form, the draft form, where it has a line for the signature of a religious leader. And I'll give you a short answer to a longer explanation. There's a long line of legal precedent in federal courts primarily, but even some in state courts, where courts have looked at whether or not it's constitutional to require membership in an organized religion in order to exercise a vaccine religious exemption. And the shorter answer is no, it's not constitutional. Different courts have ruled similarly, if sometimes differently. One court said it violates the two different clauses in the First Amendment, the free exercise and the, I'll have to find the other phrase here, not on the tip of my tongue, but two different clauses in the First Amendment. Another one has said it violates the First and 14th Amendments. But the bottom line is that there's pretty clear precedent that requiring membership in an organized religion violates the Constitution, that they really can't do that. And that's certainly problematic for the pro-vaccine folks, because that makes it easier for people to claim religious beliefs disingenuously.
And can you say can you say that again so I understand it?
If you don't have to show membership in an organized religion to get the exemption, then anybody can say they have religious objections, and they might be making it up. They might live in one of the 30 or so states that don't have a philosophical exemption, and they want to say, well, I have religious beliefs. And it's now easier, more people qualify if you don't have to be a Christian Scientist or Amish, for example. So that's a concern, because people in the pro-vaccine side are concerned that a lot of people who really don't have religious objections are going to claim religious objections so that they can avoid the vaccines, but that it's really for non-religious concerns. And that's a legitimate
How are we going to be able to distinguish? How will the people who are in authority distinguish?
Well, there's at least two pieces to that question. And the first one is, depending on the wording of the particular statute or regulation, they may or may not have authority to even make the investigation in the first place. So it's, you got to start with the language of your statute and the applicable regulations. Many states' laws are worded in such a way, in my opinion, that the state does not have authority to scrutinize the exemption claim. And if you're in a state that has that kind of a law, and if you're dealing with local officials who understand that, and unfortunately that is sometimes two different questions, then it's not so much of an issue. You know, you make the claim, you have the exemption. But some states' statutes are worded in such a way that you make the claim or you apply for the exemption, and they can say, well, no, wait a minute, you know, what are your religious beliefs? And they can scrutinize that to decide whether or not they think the beliefs are religious. And for legal purposes, the answer to that question depends on what there is in legal precedent that tells us about that.
Okay.
So that's something I'll go into detail about in my ebook. That's on the Offered
right.
by Homeopathy World Community website.
That's right. On the right-hand column, there's a little yellow square, and you just click that, and you can find out more about your ebook.
Go into detail on that, and maybe we could do a show talking about that sometime, but that's not a short answer question. But we look at the legal precedent to figure that out. And so on the one hand, as I said, that it's really broad what can qualify, but there are some legal pitfalls. Sometimes, Debbie, the law follows common sense, and what you think the law would be or should be, it often is. But there are also other times where it's not that straightforward. And this is one of those arenas where there are things that people can say or do that seem very reasonable and sensible. And yet it turns out that there's a legal technicality that it becomes a basis for rejecting the exemption claim, for example. So that's why it's really important for people who have to write a statement of beliefs to consider whether they want to get information or even perhaps a legal consultation to make sure they have a sound, legally sound.
So you're saying in both Washington State and in Colorado, either it is presently on the books or it will be, that a person who applies for a religious exemption needs to write a statement of beliefs. And
we got off a little bit. The issue in Washington, and there's variations of the same idea, the issue in Washington is that they said if you're not a member of an organized religion that has tenets opposed to immunizations, then you have to get a signature of a doctor, you know, be lectured by a doctor basically about what an awful person you are for not vaccinating. If I understand correctly, that's what the law says. In Colorado, the proposed exemption form wants to, it looks like it's requiring the signature or has a line for the signature of a religious leader. And what I'm saying is that since the federal legal precedent in particular and some state precedent says you don't have to be a member of an organized religion, they are at least strongly implying that you can't even exercise exemption unless you have a signature of a religious leader. And that's an unconstitutional requirement, in my opinion. Now, strictly speaking, the court cases that have said that that's unconstitutional come from other jurisdictions. So if Colorado wants to take a hard line on this, they can go ahead and use that form. They can say, we don't care about this federal precedent, because none of that precedent came from Colorado federal courts. And here in Colorado, it's not unconstitutional. Strictly speaking, that's correct. And let me just underscore what I mean by this, because on a common sense level, most of us would probably agree that since we have one federal constitution for the whole country, we should have the same rights under that constitution everywhere in the country. Well, we don't. And the reason we don't is because if different local courts, by local I mean different parts of the country, could be state or federal courts, but if different local courts, as opposed to the Supreme Court, which is over the whole country, rule differently, then if they interpret the Constitution differently, then we can have different rights in those different jurisdictions, different state or federal jurisdictions. So, you know, the extreme example of that in this arena is that about 30 years ago, the state Supreme Court in Mississippi ruled that vaccine religious exemptions violate the federal constitution, so they can't have a religious exemption to vaccinations in Mississippi, because in Mississippi, and only in Mississippi, it's unconstitutional, but they're perfectly constitutional in the rest of the country. West Virginia doesn't have a religious exemption, but that's not because it's unconstitutional there. It's because they haven't been able to get past the opposition in the state legislature to get a bill passed giving them one.
That really helped to clarify, especially for people who are jumping in and this is their first time listening to the show, because in past shows we've really delved pretty deeply into the Constitution and legal precedent and the different levels of government. So that was very helpful. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. It's it seems even bizarre to me. I understand it and can explain it legally, but on just sort of a common sense parent citizen level, it just seems kind of strange.
So you could pick up and move to a person could pick up and move to a different state and have different regulations and statutes and therefore goes about the vaccination issue differently in each state.
Right, and for purposes of our discussion about the proposed Colorado exemption forms, while I think it would be a bit disingenuous if Colorado, the Board of Health, were to say, well, we recognize that legal precedent, but that's not from Colorado courts, so we're going to go ahead and do our form. While there's a technical legal argument supporting that position, if that's what they choose to do, it's a bit disingenuous. And the reason I say disingenuous is because if that got challenged in court, the strong likelihood, could never guarantee what an outcome in court is going to be, but the strong likelihood is that that kind of a ruling, I mean, that kind of an issue in court would be that kind of a requirement, you know, requiring membership in an organized religion, that's going to be overturned in court far more likely than not. But technically, since it hasn't come up in the Colorado court system before, state or federal courts in Colorado, it's technically a legally unresolved issue. But anyway, there's a long line of precedent.
And to do that would take a lot of funding and a lot of time involved. I don't know whether it's years, to actually go ahead and move that up to the state or federal court level. Is that true?
It certainly could. I mean, somebody has to have a issue or conflict. They have to have what's called standing. They have to be somebody who's harmed or at imminent risk of harm of one kind or another, you know, let's say violation of their religious beliefs or something, or constitutional rights specifically, and then go through a process. Probably since this is something dealing with agency forms, you would start out in an administrative proceeding of some kind, and then if either side could potentially appeal a decision and go from there into a state or federal court, and from there on up the ladder, as long as somebody keeps appealing and the next higher court is willing to hear the matter or able to hear the matter. But it potentially could be, you know, a lengthy and expensive process for somebody challenging this. And this is what, you know, we're left with in Washington State. I think if that new law is challenged, it'll be held to be unconstitutional. But, you know, that's potentially a big if. Who's going to pull together the case and actually file it and take it to court and so forth? So
that's,
you know,
why our legal system is slow to change because of all of this.
Well, it's slow because for a lot of reasons, but there are an awful lot of rights that never get defended or exercised just for people lacking the funds to go through the system. I mean, nobody has to hire an attorney as a technical matter, but for anything more than a small claims kind of case, you are so much disadvantaged, I would say at least the majority of the time, if you don't have an attorney, just because the system is complex and you need someone who's familiar with all the different bodies of law. There are multiple bodies of law that converge with any, even the simplest case. You have rules of evidence, ethical rules, rules of procedure, the substantive law, which is the law about whatever your issue is. You have local rules in different courts and court systems in counties. And all of these are areas where there is not only the laws or the rules, but then there is potentially legal precedent to help clarify how these laws or rules apply in certain situations. I mean, these are literally multiple bodies of law that converge with any single court case. And so if you're not familiar, at least familiar with all these different areas of law, you're at a disadvantage. And so as a practical matter, even attorneys who are clients should have attorneys. As the saying goes, you know, the attorney who has himself for a client has a fool for a client or something like that. But
okay.
You know, so the practical result there, as unjust as it seems by any sort of conceptual evaluation, is that money buys justice. it's sad but true.
Okay. So we had some things on the agenda today. Did we cover all of the issues, or did you want to go further with specifically this Colorado case, or
well,
did you have something else?
Yeah, let me skim through some more things on the forum here. We could spend days if we go the way we're out here, but I just want to mention very briefly, that was just the first point of multiple points for two different forums that are addressed in my article. But let me hit some of the highlights that I think are some of the clear points. Both of the forms, the religious exemption form and the personal exemption form, list recommended vaccines. And at least as a conceptual matter, I take great exception to that, because the purpose of an exemption form is to avoid required vaccines. Recommended vaccines are irrelevant to the function of an exemption form. Recommended vaccines you can decide to do or not do without an exemption, and you don't have to do them to go to school. You know, by definition, they are not the mandated or required vaccines. So, you know, from a cynical point of view, the only reason to put recommended vaccines on there is because the Board of Health wants to function as a advertising agency for the pharmaceutical industry. But it's confusing, in my opinion, to have recommended vaccines listed on an exemption form whose function legally is to avoid the required vaccines. If the Board of Health feels obligated to promote to the citizenry the awareness of recommended vaccines that are above and beyond the required ones, they should find another way to do that. So, you know, again, this is just more evidence of the infiltration of the pharmaceutical industry into government and influence and control over government. We live in a world where, and we live in a country, those of us in the U.S., that's the most highly vaccinated country in the world, and we're also something on the order of about 47th in infant mortality. I mean, this blind trust and belief in vaccines and that more vaccines is better is just something that does not hold up to any even preliminary scrutiny, let alone an in-depth scrutiny. There's just no clear evidence when you look at, you know, the all available information. There's just no way that you can reasonably come to the conclusion that, you know, oh, vaccines are okay, let's have more of them, that's better. If the Board of Health were truly looking at all the information and basing its actions on all of the information, you know, they should be questioning whether or not to even do all the recommended vaccines, I mean all the required ones, let alone adding additional recommended vaccines. It's just highly questionable when you've got research now, for example, that shows that the more vaccines a country administers, the higher their infant mortality rate.
So they're not looking at the relationships between those two factors, but they seem to put together relationships that we question. I wanted to let people know, those people who are on the chat, I did put the link to your recent article on Natural News. That was August 3rd that you posted it. And you have a connection for people to write specifically to Joni Reynolds, RNCMN.
I wrote the article in the form of a letter to the Board of Health. And at this point, I'm not sure that I would recommend that people just copy the letter and mail it to her. But I recommend, and I say this in the article, people need to find out how and where and when it's appropriate for the public to weigh in on this. And it may be that sending a letter to this person at the Board of Health is a proper way to do that. But I have not researched Colorado's process or procedure specifically. And so I would certainly recommend...
Complaint or comment, opinions or editorials types of things. I suppose
right.
People could also write to their local and to their newspapers that get published if they have something to say.
They certainly could. But I recommend people contact either their local Department of Health or the State Department of Health and say, you know, it's come to my attention that there are some proposed vaccine forms, and I have some concerns that I would like to share. Where and when is the proper way to do that? Because a lot of people with the best of intentions spin their wheels and do things that are ineffective or potentially even counterproductive by not first investigating, well, what is the proper procedure here? And I'm going to pick on myself first and foremost when I say that. Perhaps rather than writing an article in the form of a letter, I should have made that call myself and said, when and how can do the public offer input on their concerns about this? It may be that a letter to the Board of Health is a perfectly proper way to do that, but I would encourage people in Colorado to double-check me on that before doing that. And I also encourage people in Colorado to read my letter carefully, and if there are parts of it they disagree with or don't understand, don't use them. And I say that right up front in my letter. My real intent with the letter is not so much to tell people with any total and complete precision, here's what to do and exactly how to do it, but it was really more using these forms as a basis for addressing issues that we saw come up in Washington, now in Colorado, and we're going to see them come up in other states. I can almost promise you that, because, again, growing exemption rates, growing awareness and concern about vaccines are being met with furious efforts on the other side to try to counter our information with disturbing propaganda, because what we're talking here about innocent people's lives and many, if not most of the time, children, and you know, trying to not only just save but expand their market share. I'm getting calls just in the last couple of weeks from categories of people that I've never heard from before. Vaccines are now being pushed on airline pilots, on pharmacists. It's not stopping with just the healthcare employees. Of course, we knew that was the case, would be the case. But the pro-vaccine agenda goes forward.
Yeah, why don't you list for us a couple of the areas where people are required, or these things are starting to happen even more so in the healthcare professions, you know, like nurses and physician's assistants and things like that. Can you just give like a wide range of areas where these vaccines are being required?
Well, let me give just a real quick list of the things that I see most commonly, and then I'll just briefly repeat again, you know, the newer ones I'm starting to see. I mean, one of the things that's fascinating about practice of law is that if, as you specialize in an area, you'll tend to see lots of similar things or things that fall into predictable categories. And what I'm seeing in the vaccine arena is more and new categories coming up recently, as apparently vaccines are being required in new places, bottom line. But, you know, the first thing that most people think about is schools, but even the schools category has many subdivisions, and by subdivisions, for my purposes, I mean where there can be different legal rights or different law that applies. So there's homeschools, public schools, private schools, military schools, colleges and universities, and then a subset there of those students who are doing healthcare curriculums where they have to do clinical work in nearby hospitals or other healthcare institutions, such as nursing students, med students, emergency medical people, things like that. And when you have to do clinical work in local hospitals, it's the local hospitals that decide what vaccines the students who do clinical work there have to get, not the school. So it's not a state law exemption issue, at least arguably. But there's a lot of unsettled law in that arena. Then we've got immigration, which includes foreign adoptions. People are required to be vaccinated, and there's a specific waiver process for that. We've got military, but there's separate categories for military members, military families, military contractors, and then you've got different branches of the military that can have their individual regulatory differences. So potentially multiple categories within the broader military heading. And then healthcare employees, as you were talking about, Debbie, that would be anybody who's employed. But there's a separate category that a couple of separate categories that have just come up. People who are in hospitals doing work, not as employees and not as students doing clinical work, but maybe on some kind of volunteer basis, or other kind of. Somebody called me recently doing an internship, which was not a paid position. So there's different legal questions and questions about rights and law that may or may not apply in a lot of these different situations. And then again, as I mentioned, I've heard from some pharmacists recently who are now being required to both get and give vaccines.
Wow.
Yes.
And give. They have
give. And they have to promote them. They have to offer the flu shot every time somebody's at the counter. You know, if you had a flu shot. So the pressure is really on heavy with these folks. And then an airline pilot. First time I've been contacted by an airline pilot saying that there was requirements there. So there are... we're going to see this come up more and more and in more and more areas. I fully expect to be hearing from teachers before long saying, oh, we're required to be revaccinated now because we're around all these students and, you know, we could catch a disease from them or give a disease to them or whatever.
Yes, and Victor says that top management positions for foreigners in the United States also. And I can imagine, you know, like let's say you're just doing music therapy and you're going to a facility. What about nursing homes, nursing facilities? And the thing that is happening is they're developing more and more vaccines. It seems they just want to target simply every little thing that could be an illness. And this is a problem because the body cannot cope with this many onslaughts of heavy metals, chemicals, and cocktails of dead fetal matter, and who knows what else is in there besides the specific for the vaccine. So you covered a wide, wide range of areas where these are becoming more requirements to either enter a facility, be part of a community, or be part of a educational program. These things are affecting our lives at a much deeper level than people realize.
Yes, and I guess as I think about it, I'm in a fairly unique position to, I certainly don't have a comprehensive overview of what's going on in the pro-vaccine agenda, but I certainly see a slice of that from a somewhat unique perspective in that, you know, I'm one of the people that people who have jobs, for example, where they have newly imposed vaccine requirements that they didn't have in the past. I'm one of the people that they call. So I can't say I'm surprised at this at all, but it is a disturbing trend because maybe it bodes well for me from a business point of view over the long term, and that's, I don't have a problem with that. But it concerns me deeply about this take-no-prisoners kind of approach to imposing more and more vaccines on more and more people. And I just keep coming back as a starting place to this fundamental reality that vaccines have a risk of injury and death, and I just don't see how legitimately a government or employer, for that matter, can reasonably require me to take that risk. Could they reasonably say, you know, if there's an outbreak, we're going to quarantine you or exclude you from work or something like that? Potentially, you know, there's a conversation there that could be had, but not really room for a reasonable conversation to have an absolute mandate, in my opinion.
So what people should understand is the reason that we have the show creating waves of awareness regarding vaccinations and your rights in the United States is because it really does affect everyone, not just in the United States, but universally. And Victor has just posted a link to an article in the Houston and Texas News that the title of it says, Universal Flu Vaccine Could Mean One Shot for Life. And we're going to probably have to investigate what this is all about, but...
Does that mean you die afterwards and you don't have to get any more, or is that some...
well, I'm not really sure how it works, but we know that Mother Earth is much smarter than we are, and that if we try to second-guess it, mutations can occur in nature much faster than we can go into the lab and develop something. And so we have to work with nature and increase our own bodily, mental, spiritual immunity to onslaughts of anything coming from the outside. And that is a whole nother show. But I am really, really glad that people like Victor are out there giving us, sending us information. It says, the annual flu vaccine is one of public health's greatest headaches, from the guessing game about which strains of virus will circulate in the coming season to public weariness about rolling up sleeves for the hastily produced shot. And so we're going to have to go into that one a little bit later, but it's true. It is a guessing game, and if we can keep ourselves healthy year-round and not just for each and every little thing that comes around, we're going to be in a better way. So spending, if Bill Gates would spend his trillions on producing sanitation, food, good nutritional food, organic food, cleanliness, and provide parks and build what am I going to say, parks and places for people to have community centers, that would be so much better for a region than just pull up your sleeve and get a shot. So let's see, how we've got 2 minutes left, and I'll let you finish up.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll try to squeeze in one more quick topic here, because there are many points, and I encourage folks to go to the article on Natural News to see the other points. But just another one that's a big one for me, that the personal exemption form in Colorado, and this is the same problem they have with the law that was just passed in Washington State, that they're requiring the exercise of a personal exemption for the person to get basically a lecture from a doctor and a doctor signing off on the form. So the doctor is going to explain to you, of course, a very biased point of view, because doctors professionally are not really allowed to be objective on the issue, and many of them, at least by all anecdotal reports, are not. This concerns me. You know, when the state legislature gives you the right, but then they're going to the Department of Health wants to come around and try and talk you out of it. And I really feel like the state should either give you the right or not. By giving you the right, the state legislature has said, you know, you have the ability to figure this out and decide for yourself. And it just sort of violates kind of this fundamental, it's like the state legislature is saying, yes, you have this right and you can do this, and then the Board of Health wants to come around and say, but if you're going to exercise this, you must be stupid, so we're going to educate you. And there's just something fundamentally wrong on just sort of a common sense level with somebody being given a right and then being essentially required to be reprimanded for trying to exercise it.
Yeah, I call that talking from both sides of your mouth. But
right.
Okay, so let's just let people know that you have this incredible ebook. It's not very expensive, downloadable to your computer immediately once you sign off there. It's on HWC to find the link, and you're going to learn a lot about legal precedents and the law, and it will help you make a decision whether you actually need to have an advisor or not dealing with vaccine exemptions and your rights. And I want to thank you so, so much, Alan. Always, it's going to be great. You know what we're going to talk about next time?
I would love to. Of course, we never know what news is going to happen in the next week. But I tell you, there was a recent court decision that has restricted the ability of some vaccine-injured people to get compensation through the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. It's a very disturbing federal circuit court opinion, and I would love to next week go into some detail about that case and its holding and its implications, because it's a serious progression in the ever-unfolding questions about who gets compensation and how and who can't and so forth.
Okay, thanks everyone. Until next Thursday.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Let your truth be young girl. One.